Charles McNair, how are you?
I'm happy to be here and happy to be anywhere, in fact.
You are, you're my friend. You're a friend of Sidewalk Radio. And you are the author of Pickett's Charge, a novel. Tell me about it.
I have written this tale, and by the way, you're my friend too, Gene, and thank you for having me on the show, and thanks for doing the show that you do and celebrating our community, this wonderful town we live in. It's a great city, and you help point people to the great places in the great city and tell the context and backstory for why Atlanta matters and how to have adventures here.
So well, thank you.
I appreciate that very much. I've written a book, Pickett's Charge, is the story of a 114-year-old Confederate veteran.
A spring chicken.
He's a sprung chicken, as it turns out. He learns that there is just one Yankee still alive in up north. And he leaves his nursing home and heads north to fight the last battle of the Civil War. He travels through the 1960s, and he has the chance, as he passes through this revelatory decade, 1964 is the year, through civil rights and hippie times and the counterculture and all the strangeness of that collective nervous breakdown called the 1960s. And he has a chance to really, along that journey, to examine whether the vengeance that he has clung to so pridefully and fiercely all these years is really the right thing in the end. And so I can't call it a novel of redemption. I can't call it a novel of damnation. If I call it either of those things, it will give away the ending, and so I prefer not to do that. But that's the tale.
Let's not do that. But, you know, I think it's extremely worthwhile to mention that today is the 50th year anniversary of Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech.
I've been listening to the all day long on radio to the speeches and the different profiles that have been going on. And it has reminded me that purely, really by serendipity, I began writing a story of an old Civil War veteran and the history of his life, which is mostly the 1860s. But by having him move forward in the 1960s, there's also this other tremendously significant decade in our American history that I get to explore in this fiction. And I didn't set out to do that. I really thought this was more of a novel about what happened 150 years ago. And it turns out that it's just as much about what happened 50 years ago.
Did you find it surprising? We all know the dates, but that it took that long for civil rights to come to true fruition?
That's exactly what this book is about. In this novel, at age 14, Threadgill Pickett and his twin brother Ben set off from Eufaula, Alabama, to join the Confederate Army. They've heard that the Army is somewhere up in, near Atlanta, and indeed that's where the Sherman campaign is coming. And they get as far as Pine Mountain, where something terrible happens. And that terrible thing leaves Threadgill Pickett vengeful and disfigured. And for the next 100 years, he nurses his vengeance and broods over his defeat, just like we did here in the South. And so he's a metaphor for all of us here. Now, you know, I'm a white guy, so I'm writing about sort of the general effect through the eyes of white society here. You know, if you were a black person, you didn't lose the war. You won the war. And nevertheless, it still took 100 years for equality to begin. That was just the point where it really began. And we are still filling the vessel now.
Well, for those who don't know yet, they need to know that you also have one of my favorite radio shows, which is your book reviews. And You all need to check that out, by the way. Did you find it difficult to write this, your second novel, the first one, Land of Goshen? Did you find it more difficult to write this being a reviewer of books?
Actually, it's a great help to be a reviewer of books, because the nourishment that every writer gets isn't from the food they eat, although that's one kind of nourishment, but it's from the brain food they eat. And I'll tell you, if you're, there's a terrible Sophie's choice that many writers who also work for a living. I do corporate writing. I, you know, have big corporations who call me on the phone. My marketing plan is to answer the phone, thank goodness. So being in demand is fun. But the big decision is, you come home at the end of the day, or you get up from the end of the desk at, after a day of work, and you have this Sophie's choice to make. How's that for a literary reference? You can choose between reading a novel, reading something instructive that will teach you how to write better and fill you up with ideas, or you can sit down and write and try and make something that you are working on go forward. You generally don't have the energy to do both things, or I don't. Let me subjectify this. And so one of the things when I became a book reviewer that happened was I no longer could languish as a reader. I was always writing. Every night there's something that comes out. But I wasn't always reading. And having metrics, measurements, deadlines to force me to take material that I'd usually read, the classics, sometimes read them again, or read books freshly that I'd never read before, I read them differently 30 years ago than I do now. The books are different. I'm different. The perceptions are different. The wisdom is different.
The landscape's different.
The landscape out here is different. They all these books mean a completely different thing after you, when you read them again. I remember the impact, especially that that the book Slaughterhouse-Five had, because I had read that some years back, and in college, and I was a collegian then. I was sophomoric. And it meant one thing then and one set of things. And now, all these years, all these wars, all these events, and all of the experiences later have fed the book a whole new set of perceptions that I value so much. Also, being a reviewer has, you look around sometimes, you say, oh my gosh, the deadline is coming. I need to get to the station with some material. And what is a book that I can pick up and read that that I can read fast and that I've never read? And lo and behold, here on my shelf just happens to be a copy of Treasure Island. I'd never read Treasure Island. And I was astonished at how...
Great book.
What vitality is in that book, and how cinematic and modern Robert Louis Stevenson's... it's just a gallop. Of a story.
But was there any pressure? And so this visit together, this conversation, is as much about Pickett's Charge as a talking point as it is really about being an author, being a writer, and what that's like as a profession and some of the struggles that you have to go through. And I was just curious, like, being a reviewer, you know how to be critical. Now, your reviews are really very nice, and I think you pick material that it seems like you enjoy. And as the listener and future reader or previous reader of those books, I can enjoy, or the listener can enjoy. But you also have to look at it critically. And does that kind of play in to your writing?
Absolutely it does, because your judgment meter, what would you call this thing, your critical sensibility, is sharpened by the things you read. When you find a paragraph in a Dickens where you find a paragraph in Dubliners, or my very favorite, Ken Kesey, is my hero as a writer. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest is my favorite book. And if you read a paragraph from that book, and at the end you say, my gosh, how did he do that? How did he make me feel what I have felt at the end of this paragraph? And then you go back and you look at sentence by sentence, just how he put the sentences together and how the character came into the room, what the description was that made you immediately sense a reality outside your own head. And so those are the things you learn from critical reading.
Did the Kesey book, did anything jump to your mind when you were telling me about that with Pickett's Charge? Was there a place in here, a chapter, a moment? Can you share that with us?
I would say that Mr. Pickett is, and I won't give too much away by telling this, but Mr. Pickett is a mean man and a hard man, and you love him, but he is obstinate and obdurate in his vengeful view of things, and he cannot let it go. He is so mean, in fact, and so focused on his vengeance that when he contracts rabies, he refuses to die, and he confronts, in this very surreal scene, he confronts death itself, and in a good old Southern tall tale type of set piece, he has a fist fight with death and beats his butt. That's how tough and how mean and focused Threadgill Pickett is. Now, that kind of piece is not pure fiction. It's not you are reading as close to reality as you can. I'm doing what Kesey often does in his stories, which is he takes things from an almost psychedelic viewpoint, and he expands and makes preposterous and giganticizes certain scenes so that you know they can't be true, but they are true through the eyes of his narrator, Chief Broom, in that book, who, by the way, is in an insane asylum, and whose point of view may or may not be reliable. You don't really know. You put yourself in his hands, and it's like the greatest opening line in all of fiction, which is from Kafka, The Metamorphosis. One morning, as Gregor Samsa awoke from uneasy dreams, he found he had been transformed in his bed into a gigantic insect. Now, I'm going to tell you, if you buy that line, if you read that line and go one inch further, he has the hook in your mouth so deep, and he can do anything with you that he wants after that. The story can. And so that's sort of my approach to this. I come from the tall tale tradition. I come from people who sat on their porches and one would turn to the next and say, you know, Rudolph, do you know anybody with the phone company? No, I don't know anybody with phone company. Why do you ask? Well, I got these tomatoes growing, and they're growing pretty good, and I'm going to need some stakes for them. I thought you might be able to get me some telephone poles. So that kind of exaggeration for fun is really, it's the tall tale from Twain.
Well, you can tell in talking to you how important reading has been in your writing.
Absolutely.
Here's my question. How important is writing, both to you as an author and for a world of readers?
What am I if I'm not a writer? Let me go back to a time in my life when I was 15. I had a wonderful teacher in Dothan, Alabama, a woman named Lois Baker. She had had a misfortunate life. She married a young man on the eve of World War II. He went off to Europe, never came home. And Miss Baker never remarried. She married herself to the junior high school in Dothan. in the 50s, she had an automobile accident and lost her right arm. And nevertheless, made it back on her feet, came to school, stood in front of the English classrooms in junior high in Dothan, Alabama, a little peanut farming community at the time, diagramming sentences to like her life depended on it. Who cared? All the kids. You know how cruel kids are. I was cruel. You know, I had made my share of Mrs. Baker jokes. But one day I was leaving the classroom, and I felt this strong left arm pinch my shoulder. And I turned around and looked into her bifocals. Her eyes were huge, like owl eyes. And she said to me, "Charles, I want you to stay after class. I want to talk about something with you." And I said, "Oh my gosh, what have I done? I'm doomed." And
you were scared?
Terrified. And she sat me down and she said, "Charles, I've been reading the papers you've been turning in and the sentences you've been writing with vocabulary words, and I think you can really write. I would like for you to be on the newspaper staff here at Young Junior High School." So I bounded out of the room. Oh, whew, is that all? Wow. You know, it didn't occur to me that it was a changing point in my life.
Had you thought about writing before that?
I had, not really at all. You know, I loved to read. I was the kid who lay, you know, instead of going hunting with the boys, I would stay home and read. That was my thing.
It's kind of interesting. And just a quick segue, I had something similar from a business perspective, and not in what seems like to be a mentor or teacher role, but I was at a friend's house, and his father was interesting and smart and pretty cool and successful, and he didn't go to work really, but he was doing things. Mm-hmm. And I said, "What's your dad do?" I was young. He said, "He's an entrepreneur." I had no idea what that meant, but I knew I wanted to be that.
He must be French.
But anyway, so it's kind of interesting. Like, you know, I start businesses, and I like to analyze opportunities and be creative. Mm-hmm. Big parts of entrepreneurship, and it just kind of like happened one day. So it's cool that you had that experience too.
Well, and there's a little more to this. I wrote a couple of pieces for the little newspaper, and then one Friday afternoon, the very first issue in which I had a role appeared, and there was a short story that I'd written with my name under it. And I'm proud of it. I think, you know, but I'm callow. I'm just, you know, 14 or 15. What do I really know about things? It's the age when every young man, and it probably every young woman too, but I'm a guy, so I can speak, you know, authoritatively about this, is looking for an identity. Who am I? How do I stand out from all these other Joes? Am I the motorcycle guy? Am I the singer? Am I the guitar player? What makes me unique? So that's that afternoon. I leave the classroom, last class of the day. I'm going down the hall. There's this tremendous racket up and down the hall where people are slamming their lockers and getting their books and getting the heck out of there because it's Friday. And I'll never forget walking by two of the lockers. There was a great tall guy there named Billy Snell, and he was talking to another fellow named Jerry Maddox. And Billy Snell was 6'4" in the eighth grade, had a huge Adam's apple, and this the deepest voice you've ever heard. And he turns to Jerry Maddox, and he foghorns to him. He said, "There goes Charles. He's a writer." And from that moment to this, whether it was born into me genetically or whether the road split right there when I had that sudden label identity, I became a writer. And that was my path. And so, Mrs. Baker, wherever you are out there, I thank you for the gift you gave me.
It's a touching and telling story. I also see that you dedicated this novel to your parents. They must have had a pretty significant impact on your life, your writing.
Well, just as from the reading, I'm a writer, and the writing, then from the flesh and blood, I owe them everything. I will tell you that my dad, I honestly believe, probably never read a book in his life. He came from a middle-class family. His dad ran the mail route in Troy, Alabama. And Daddy grew up, you know, not poor, you know, middle class, with their own dad, my granddaddy, having a steady job. But he was not a reader, and he was something of a bounder. He ran away from home at 15. When he settled down finally, and, you know, in Dothan with my mom, he undertook to start building houses, and he created...
Real quick, about the running away, because that's kind of one of those things where if you've read Huckleberry Finn, you want to run away. But when you run away, and it's your first night out there, it's not Huckleberry Finn any longer.
It is not. And I, too, ran away. In college years, I dropped out of school, and I turned 20 years old and understood that I had never been or done anything on my own, ever. I'd always played by somebody else's playbook. And so within 1 week, I got drunk for the first time, stoned for the first time, laid for the first time, and I dropped out of college and hitchhiked to Mexico.
And sounds like an adventurous week.
It was the Declaration of McNair Independence, and I there too is another fork in the road in a life. After that, I was pretty much always just a writer. That's all I ever have been serious about, honestly. And so I was homeless those 3 months, and you are absolutely right, Gene Kansas. It ain't Huckleberry Finn. There is not a raft, and there's not a friend on the raft. Every ride I got hitching, I feared in some deep place. Nothing ever happened. Nothing, you know, I had no bad adventures. I had a lot of good adventures. But the rides while you're hitchhiking have a habit of telling you these terrible things. Like one picks you up and says, "Well, did you hear about those two hobos?" And I'm thinking, "Oh my God." And he says, "Yeah, they found them chopped up in little pieces in a boxcar over in Waco this morning." There's a long silence in the car after that, I promise you.
Yeah. I mean, but it's scary. But it also sounds kind of lonely. And but you can't change that. You can't just have a new friend. You can't just have some new meaning, especially for someone who's searching for that, newly independent. It has to come. But there's also, like, and I, too, am a writer, not to your level. I'm more on kind of the copywriting, storytelling in a different way.
It's type all words
narrative.
And all stories, man.
It's all writing, and there is a bit that... There is a necessary independence with that, and there is a degree of loneliness with that.
I am. Here is another of the Sophie's choices that I am the most gregarious and fun-loving, sociable guy. I love people. I love conversation. I love the swirl, but that is utterly incompatible with what you have to do if you're a writer. You have to have solitude. You have to have a quiet place. You have to be away from people. And so there's this Jekyll and Hyde-ness that goes on. I work mostly alone and many days untroubled all day long. And there comes a point in the evening where in an exact flip side of most people's lives. Most people work all day and they're strung out and they're tired of talking to people. My girlfriend, Margaret, has this. And they just want to sit down and put their feet up at the end of the day. Me, I've been all by myself. I've been in the space capsule, hello, Major Tom. And I have to, or I go kind of crazy. I have to go out and I have to go sit in a place where there's noise and vivacity and celebration and color, and it's like a bee getting pollen. I've got to go get it or I am not going to be healthy. And so you're absolutely right about that grinding loneliness of being a writer.
And so going back to your dad, and this is not a therapy session, y'all, but it's just interesting, and I think that people want to know about the authors who are reading. I mean, it's about the book, but the book is written by you. So, about your dad, he, to your knowledge, never read a book, or you don't think he did. He ran away from home. Then what happened?
And then he made good. He bounced around. He's one of those kids that his dad, because he found him asleep in a dairy barn in Troy, Alabama, took him down and to the military. And he joined the Air Force a year before he was supposed to be able to, 17. They got him in, and he did two tours in the Philippines. This was smack between Korea and and World War II, so he didn't go out and get killed like Mrs. Baker's husband. And came home and found a pretty co-ed at Troy State University on the tennis court one day, and wolf whistled at her from a car, and one thing led to another, and here I am. And five brothers and sisters after me. And he found something that he was really good at. He was really good at business. And really that's what we're talking about here. I found something that I was really good at. I was different from other people in the level of ability for whatever reason. You know, I'm not pretending it's mine, but imagination and the willingness to put in the hours, I'm different. He was different, but his passion, his bliss that he followed was making money, and he made enough to begin doing another passion, which was buying some land around Dothan, Alabama, and planting pine trees on it. I bet you I have hand planted 100,000 pine trees in my life with that divil, that heavy metal instrument, and I've driven 1,000,000 nails, and I've dug miles.
He's hucking us, y'all.
I'm hucking you. I have dug miles of ditches for the foundations of houses working with under my dad. My dad, my mom, in the meantime, had four babies before she was four babies under the age of six, and somehow kept us all fed and dinner on the table at supper, we called it, on the table at night, and a minimum of pink eye and cuts and bruises, and did it with a good humor. And really, I think my dad is where the discipline came from, and my mom's creative mind. She could imagine her way into whatever and wherever.
Hence the dedication for the discipline, the creativity.
To those two people.
That's nice. Let's talk about, you. It's so funny. I didn't really have a plan except to come in here and talk to a friend who I admire. But I'm holding Pickett's Charge, and I'm looking at the cover, and they say don't judge a book by its cover, but at least we can dissect the book a little bit by its cover. Will you just describe it and kind of some of the imagery and why it's there?
One of the icons in the book is the old battered hat that Threadgill Pickett wears to conceal a disfigurement that happened during this terrible moment when he was 14. He also loses his brother, his twin. And that hat, in the band of it, he wears a yellowhammer feather, a feather from a kind of woodpecker that is common in Alabama and Georgia. The yellowhammer happens to be Southern soldiers, Alabama soldiers, when they went off to the Civil War, wore in the band of their hat a yellowhammer feather, which is why Alabama is called the Yellowhammer State. And which is why the cheer at the University of Alabama, rammer jammer, yellowhammer, give them hell, Alabama. That's why, the only reason the word yellowhammer appears in it. So on the cover, you see a yellowhammer that makes the I of the word picket, a little bird. And the apostrophe between the two T's and the S in Pickett's is a feather, like the one that Threadgill wears in his hat. The background is Confederate gray. The typeface is an 1860s typeface. And there is a yellow chevron where my name, the author's name, is, that takes about the bottom third of the book, bright yellow. And that is from the chevrons that were worn on the sleeves of the Confederate soldiers in that time. So this jacket is, fraught with symbolism.
I would expect nothing less.
And there's also, luckily, an endorsement from Charles Frazier, the writer who wrote Cold Mountain, the huge bestseller from some years back. And he has been good enough to blurb the book, along with Mark Childress, who used to live here in Atlanta, Ron Rash, one of the greatest Southern writers alive today, Colin McCann, who won the National Book Award a few years ago, Tom Mullen, who lives here in town, a great little writer, John Holman, who teaches at Georgia State, Jack Pendarvis over at Oxford, and Tom Franklin over at Oxford, and Tom Genode of Esquire, who you occasionally hear on WMLB, but who is probably the greatest magazine journalist drawing breath today. And all of these people have praised this book, for which I am deeply grateful. Roseanne Cash has endorsed the hardback, and her name, too, will be there. She's a great writer. Everybody knows her as a great musician, but she's a wonderfully talented writer and was so crazy about this book.
Well, let's do, for the sake of the prospective reader, a quick little sales pitch on where they can get it.
The first availability of the book will be Labor Day weekend at, and I don't know if this pre or post dates your show, Gene, so probably that would be before the show. But if, just in case it's out beforehand, the Labor Day weekend, I am part of two different panels on Saturday at 4:15. At 4:15, I'm on a panel with Matthew Gwynn, who's written this wonderful book called The Resurrectionist, about a black man who digs up corpses and sells them to the medical school at a place fictionally like Augusta Medical College in the early years. And he and I are on a panel talking about digging up the past and writing about historical fiction. And then on Sunday, I am at noon on a panel of book reviewers. And one of those is, there's several very fine ones, at Kate Tuttle, Karen Van Atten from the AJC.
Is this part of the Decatur Book Festival?
It is. It is okay. The Decatur Book Festival.
Nice.
And Lev Grossman from Time
Magazine. Well, I'm glad to hear it, because I'll go, but this show more than likely will air after. So can people go online to Amazon, or how do they get it?
Right. If you're in the sound of this voice, I would ask that you support your indie bookstore and order from Eagle Eye, Acapella, or Acapella Eagle Eye, as you prefer. Both you can pre-order, and both are already getting a lot of orders in. You can also order online from Amazon, from Indie Books, from Barnes & Noble, and they would be very happy to order for you. My launch event, which, again, if you're listening to this, you're welcome to come to. In fact, please come and bring a friend or your posse. The more the merrier. That is Wednesday, August 25th. I'm sorry, Wednesday, September 25th, uh-huh, at Manuel's Tavern at 7 o'clock in the evening.
All right, so we'll make a little note on that and make sure to get the word out there. Now, this might be a little bit more challenging, but if you were to review this book, and try to do this without bias, I'm going to really challenge you. Give me your, bottom line couple of sentence review here.
I would say on the plus side that this book is a tremendously imaginative, that the set pieces, especially the historical pieces from Threadgill's past life, are believable And the Civil War scenes are extremely compelling. The battle scenes are extremely compelling. I would say maybe on the negative side of the ledger that because the 1960s sections are written in a Ken Kesey and Vonnegut style more, that may not be a style that appeals to every single reader. But if you have a taste for the kind of fiction that that made Kesey and Vonnegut the kinds of writers they are, that it will be your cup of tea.
Fabulous. Well, thank you so much for sharing your story and your stories with us.
I'm very happy to be here, and all I can say, Gene, is thanks for supporting writers and books.
Thank you. Very nice.